Welcome to Preaching Podcasts for Those Who Proclaim Publicly. This is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School for Ministry in the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania, where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives to help prepare church leaders for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me is Althea Spencer-Miller and Josh Davis.
Hello, everyone. Hey, Deirdre. Josh.
Hi.
Hello, both of you. And hello, everyone out there. Good to be with you again.
Wonderful. Wonderful to be with you both, too. And we are planning some future podcasts, just a little teaser. We're talking about guests we might be able to invite, guests we will invite, and with whom we will have the three-way or four-way or five-way dialogue. So we're planning that for later on in the Epiphany season and then perhaps further into Lent as we get closer to Easter. So just to let you know what might be happening, you might hear different voices, and that would be because we've got some new voices. Very excited about that. Today we're on Epiphany 6, the sixth Sunday after Epiphany. And we're getting closer to the end of Epiphany, but we haven't yet quite dispensed with the themes that we have been following: the manifestation of light, the meaning of Epiphany is appearance, shining, and what we've been tracing is God's manifestation throughout the world. We've also been looking at specific places where we see the light of God manifest, for example, in the journey of the Magi to Jesus' birthplace. And we've got the manifestation of God in the baptism of Jesus, which really kicks off the season of Epiphany. We've been talking about ways in which the manifestation of God is clear in human arrangements and human communities, and that is through God's justice, through the manifestation of God's justice, through God's just dispensation. And so we see this today in the readings from Epiphany 6. We see, for example, this fantastic concluding passage to Deuteronomy chapter 30, where Moses is saying to the Israelite people in this sort of pivotal moment, standing and declaring to them that before you today, I have set life and prosperity, death and adversity. They are, as it were, standing at a crossroads. And so we will discuss the Deuteronomy reading, and its exemplification is the choice that the Israelites would make, Moses hopes, to obey the commandments of the Lord your God that Moses is commanding them today. So that's a great reading from the closure of the law codes in Deuteronomy. Of course, the Sirach passage, which is an alternative, is a wisdom. Sirach is the wisdom of Jesus ben Sirach. It's a piece of wisdom literature. And Sirach echoes the choice of Deuteronomy. If you choose, you can keep the commandments. So it's a wisdom take on the same kind of narrative choice of Deuteronomy 30. Great is the wisdom of the Lord. Before each person, a life or death, whichever one chooses will be given. God's eyes are on those who fear him, and so on and so on. So Psalm 119, I'm of two minds about Psalm 119, but that's only because of its structure. It's one of those extremely long psalms, and it's structured in such a way that it is meant to be a long psalm because it reflects the organizing principle of the use of the Hebrew by way of taking each letter of the Hebrew alphabet and then working that out in the course of units of material. That doesn't mean that we can't look at the content. And the content of Psalm 119, verse 1, happy are those whose way is blameless, who walk in the law of the Lord, and those who observe his decrees. And that's, again, the choice of Deuteronomy 30. 1 Corinthians 3, this continues tracing the epistle to the Corinthians, the letter to the Corinthians by Paul, in which the Corinthians are identified as spiritual people, pneumatikoi, we would say in Greek. And this designation, I think we said this last time, spiritual people is a self-designation, maybe suggested by Paul, but certainly adopted by the Corinthians as those who are Jesus followers. And the meaning of spiritual people is worked out in the course of the passage. What does it mean to be a spiritual person in Christ? We'll look at that in the context of what's going on at Corinth, the whole question about divisions and tensions based on, you know, human associations, who baptized whom, and does it matter? The passage from Matthew's Gospel is right at the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. We were talking about the Sermon on the Mount not very long ago, last week, and this passage opens up what scholars have traditionally called Jesus says in this mode of teaching, you have, he says to the listeners, you have heard X, but I say to you Y. And this Y is not simply an alternative, go left, go right, make a choice between these two paths, but rather the choice Jesus is suggesting and indeed recommending is the choice to intensify the observance of, in the first case, not murdering. So we'll discuss the form, we'll discuss the content of the gospel reading. The collect, O God, the strength of all who put their trust in you, mercifully accept our prayers, and because in our weakness we can do nothing good without you, give us the help of your grace, that in keeping your commandments we may please you both in will and deed through Jesus Christ our Lord, who lives and reigns with you in the Holy Spirit. So here we see the emphasis upon the grace of God. We see the emphasis upon keeping the commandments. And so I suppose a good theme for today would be what are the commandments, Deuteronomy 30, Matthew 5, 21 to 37, Psalm 119, observance of the law. And what does it take to keep them? What does it mean to keep them? Those are some thoughts about today's readings. Where should we start?
Oh my gosh.
Well, isn't it? I don't even know where to start because there's so much going on here. But isn't it true, or would it be fair to say that this particular perspective represented in Deuteronomy is one perspective of the Hebrew Bible, right? The path of life and the path of death, that characterizes the group of texts, which in the Hebrew Bible runs from, let's say, the book of Joshua to the end of 2 Kings, where that whole block of text, known as the Deuteronomistic history, right, seems to run along these lines. If you take the path of death, then you will be cursed, or you may choose the path of life, which is to follow or observe Torah, and this will lead to life. And there are alternate strands running through the Hebrew Bible and even in the New Testament with respect to this, right? This is how I read this.
Yes. Are you thinking in the New Testament of something like the language of choice? The narrow way in the Sermon on the Mount, you know, there's a broad way that leads to destruction and a narrow way that leads to life, that kind of thing, because that's part of Jesus' words.
I was thinking of Paul, actually.
Paul, okay.
I tend to read Paul as in Galatians and Romans, pushing mm-hmm. back against this way of looking at things, right? Grouping things, but that may be a much broader conversation.
I'm thinking with what you said, Deirdre, and we can see how this might connect to what Josh is saying. Mm. When you ask the question, what are the commandments? I thought about a number of terms that we could use to think about that question. One term was what is the content? What are the specific kinds of commandments mm-hmm. that we have? Another is what categories of of social organization or religious organization do they fall into?
Mm-hmm.
But I also thought about, you know, with what the Hebrews have been through in Exodus and Deuteronomy, and then the timing, the time context of Sirach, you know, what is the role and function of these commandments? What are they meant to do for the first the disparate peoples who are being pulled together in Deuteronomy, and for the peoples who are facing an unsettled history of changing hegemonies, that contextualizes this reminder, this forceful exhortation that Sirach brings forth. So what are they? What work is it to do? Are these commandments to do among these people?
Mm-hmm. And our ongoing, and just to say a little bit about what I was suggesting is that what we've gotten to before in our previous discussions about the incorporation of the Gentiles. So, you know, the Torah, following Torah, observing the commandments being the path of life, and those without Torah, or if you stray away from the observance of Torah, you're setting down on the path of death and cursing. So there's an easy way of dividing between the insider and outsider, Jew and Gentile, or et cetera, along these lines, which anybody who is making the argument that Gentiles should be incorporated into the people, the promise of election to Israel, would have to deal with, especially if you've got another group saying, well, when they come in, yes, but they've got to observe Torah, particularly. For this reason, because that's the way of life.
So I might be in question mode rather than answer mode, and maybe response will come a little later. But what you just said, Josh, also connected me through to Jesus in Matthew, connected what I was thinking about to Jesus in Matthew, because there is in the implicit in the you have heard that it was said, a reference to received traditions that have constituted a people's. But now he comes, he has this key, this but, I say to you, and I liked how Deirdre put it, an intensification of the commandments. They say also an intensification, but also a different kind of texturing of the commandments as he does it, and it might even be harder, stronger. But when he disrupts the traditions with a new way of thinking, and he's presenting this way, presumably, as a way that leads to life.
Mm-hmm.
But how I suppose I'm wondering, how does the disruption that he introduces here, how does a turning of the way that he has here fit into the earlier traditions where the language of the commandments was sort of lodged in this idea of you're either choosing life or you're choosing death? You know, so
yeah, because it doesn't set up a choice. It doesn't set up a choice, choose X or choose Y. It says it takes for granted. And this is why it's helpful. I know our gospel starts at 5:21 in Matthew, but if you look at 5:17, just before 5:21, Jesus says, "Don't think I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've come not to abolish, but to fulfill them. Nothing in heaven and earth will pass away until the law is all the law, from the law until it's all accomplished." So you can't break one of the least of these. So here's the way by which you've made your choice. And now let's see how it's enacted. I suppose in my mind, this is a kind of a literalism that I know you both will find surprising. I think of Joseph. So Joseph in Matthew's gospel is introduced as a righteous man, and a righteous man at Sadakah is someone who keeps the law. So, okay, so he keeps the law, and then he decides that he's getting married, and then he discovers that Mary is pregnant, and he knows he's not the father, and then he decides to divorce, to set her aside quietly, not publicly, shamefully, and so on. And an angel comes along and says, I'll show you the intensification by which you can keep the commands. That's not what the angel right. says, but I'm projecting my higher righteousness onto the angel's words. And then he realizes there is another way by which I can do what God wants. I will not set Mary aside. I will get married, and I will now enter into a whole new path of righteousness. And that path of righteousness saves the life of the child and leads to,
right.
yeah, you see what I'm getting at? Mm-hmm. So is that one way of thinking about it? It's a way by which you can think about it without saying, oh, this is about Christians or non-Christians. No, it isn't really, because Joseph is, you know, Joseph
right.
makes it all possible. He makes it all possible because of the divine intervention that he enacts.
Mm-hmm. And he kind of, that's good. I think the reference to Joseph, he kind of muddies the waters in a sense. And I'm sorry, Deirdre, I really did not hear the literalism in what you just said.
Oh, good. good.
That example, he kind of muddies the waters. It's as if you pay attention to the word of the law, and you think by attending to the word and figuring out the specifications of word meaning that you have discovered the intent of the law. Mm. If that's where you are, then Joseph kind of muddies that with the intervention of an angel. And sort of begins to point to the largesse of the law, the
exactly.
largesse of righteousness.
Exactly.
Where now, if you were paying attention, to use Jesus' terms, to the jit and tot, jottle, what was that? Tit and jottle, I'm getting my consonant confused.
Jottle, jottle, yeah.
Then you would not do what Joseph did.
Yep.
But if you're paying attention to the kind of moral compass in terms of how we shape the fabric of our life together, then Joseph has articulated something that may not be as visible just in the words, but that higher righteousness by doing something good and right for the woman whom presumably he has developed a relationship and some trust with.
Yep. Very helpful. Very helpful.
A.J. Levine, who's a Jewish New Testament scholar, taught at Vanderbilt, is to say that this was Jesus putting a hedge around the law, using a term of to describe, it's a Jewish term for describing, like, you know, limits, setting boundaries around which you could approach without actually breaking a commandment. I believe that's how she read it. Nevertheless, an intensification, it seems to me, I don't know if that's exactly correct. It's helpful in terms of thinking about what's going on here, but it's clear he's getting at something, like the contrast in adultery is about what's in your heart, right?
Yep.
And maybe it could help for us to have a discussion about what that means, to be in your heart. But it's an intensification of what the commandment actually requires, so as to talk about the orientation of yourself, as opposed to just whether you do or do not do some objective thing. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that's absolutely fair to say. Yes, because he will later say, if your eye is evil, your whole self is bad. So that the somatic, the bodily, the physical orientation of your glance, you know, and here I'm thinking of glance as the ancient world would have understood it, which was that there was a light inside and that light projected so that you could see more clearly outside. I'm not thinking of modern ophthalmology notions, but the location of justice in physical actions in the physical self is part of Matthew's anthropology. You can't be good if your eye is evil.
Mm-hmm. Right, because you're seeing or you're looking at the things which you how does that play out? It like the project. It's almost like the good or evil is being projected out of your eye.
Yes,
right.
Exactly. Which is here too. Everyone who looks, there's that looking at a woman with lust. Yeah, has already mm-hmm. committed adultery. That's right. So it isn't as you said, Josh. It isn't a question of, oh, I don't do that. I do this. It's much more the physical, somatic, bodily orientation of the mind and the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I am wishing that I was there in the moment with Jesus when he might have used these words. I'd love to have been able to at least know the context in which he was thinking. And maybe I am wishing that because I find these words frightening. the particular section that we're focusing on, you shall not commit adultery.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just look at a woman, and that is such a heterosexual position, mm-hmm. I imagine. Mm-hmm. If you look at a woman with lust, you have already committed adultery. I don't know what is the scope of lust for Jesus here, but it seems to me that perhaps in Christian tradition, we have included in it anything from thinking, oh, that's a beautiful woman, to, oh, I would love to be with that woman. You know, and if you start at the more innocent point, mm-hmm. isn't that a beautiful woman?
Mm-hmm.
And have you already committed adultery? It at what point does adultery kick in? And I'm not meaning to just be picky about it. I really am trying to find my way through a very, very harsh application of committing adultery here, one that goes into the very secret places of a mm-hmm. human person and seems not to permit that you even think about the desirability of another human being if you're already married.
Which seems utterly impractical in the sense of, like, even just at the level of, like, just the continuation of life on Earth.
Life. Yeah.
I did a little bit of looking into this, and I don't know if this is helpful or not, but that the word here is gyne, which would suggest as distinct from a virgin or a maiden or mm-hmm. something like this. So mm-hmm. suggesting that it's like the idea of looking with the intent of violating the marriage covenant of another person's wife was the suggestion that I saw. Whether that's convincing or not to you two New Testament scholars is a different matter, but that's the...
I find that helpful. And perhaps a corrective, because I think within the Christian tradition, we've had an elasticity around the term lust mm-hmm. and its applications. So you've introduced something else there, Josh, that I'm thinking about in light of what follows, cutting off your body parts if they lead you into sin. And, you know, sometimes I wonder about the tone of which mm-hmm. you read something. Should mm-hmm. this be read with high authority and sternness, with a clear indication that if you do this, this is what will happen? Mm-hmm. Or is there a tongue-in-cheek somewhere
right.
that makes right. it so hyperbolic a statement?
Right.
That it does some, what follows modifies something in the passage. I don't know, but I think that is coming from out of me because it just is such a severe and frightening.
And I would, and I meant to make one other observation, which is that they commending that particular reading is the fact that just following that statement, he talks specifically about divorce too, which I think is also so interesting. So
I think if we put it also in the wider context of Matthew, say if we were to remember that in chapter 19, Jesus commends amongst the three classes of eunuchs, disciples who are eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Not those who have been born eunuchs or those who have been made eunuchs by other people, but a class of disciples who are eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is absolutely weird, and most people don't read chapter 19 in the lectionary for obvious reasons, but I think it's our obligation to point out the wider context of the gospel in which we can see that a male disciple being a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom, you know, in a community of other male disciples who for 3 years have given up some trappings of married life. I mean, really, it might mean just set aside. Are following Jesus in the course of Jesus' itinerant ministry, and it's not really a permanent condition. That might be helpful in the light of this passage. It probably isn't the way Leo Tolstoy understood the Sermon on the Mount, as you know, the epitome of Jesus' teachings. But it's a way of taking chapter 19 into account as well.
So what would the upshot of that be in relationship to this passage?
Well, it would mean that it would put a temporary framework on this, which would not be the way that Christian tradition has understood this at all. but it would do it in the light of chapter 19. And it would remind us, as Althea has implicitly done, that this is a teaching that can only be carried out by male disciples.
I don't know that that's possible, but that's a separate matter. I don't know that that makes it any more yet plausible, but you're saying that it only applies.
Only applies. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Because all the language makes it clear that the people who are hearing this, even if it's you plural, clearly a male audience is in mind. And that, of course, drove me immediately to chapter 19, where we're talking about male eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom.
I can't help but make this poke, and pardon me, folk find it provocative, which might not be a bad thing. But, you know, even when I said it, that is for, you know, it's about home. It's about men, the male gaze.
Yep.
You know, I was assuming that Jesus never thought about gay folk when he was making statements like this.
Yeah.
Because in a queer reading, then how would a woman hear this? But I wanted to pick up on what you said, Deirdre, about the eunuchs and to contemplate the separation of body parts, the loss of body parts. And I don't know to what extent they might have been very literal about this. I know that there are cultures that get very literal about removing body parts, fingers, given in the case of theft. So I know it can become very literal, but it's such an oversized response to the situation. That the very size of it makes me ponder the image of dismemberment as an expression of the value of something.
Yeah.
And I'm connecting it to Josh's helpful statement that confines looking at a woman with lust as a breaching of the marital covenant. Think about, it's not just that you do not go and have sex with someone to whom you are not married. It is how deeply you can understand the way in which this breaks a practice that is such a part of the community's fabric.
Yes.
A practice upon which the continuity of a people's,
yes,
and the organization of a people's life depends, that it's not just, oh, I went and had sex with someone else. It's an articulation of your disposition towards the community in which you belong.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I mean, you are not treating people as objects. We can certainly say that.
It's about the covenant within which you have made a covenant with a woman, and I'm speaking from the perspective of the man that he's speaking about here.
Yeah.
You've made a covenant with a woman, and another man has made a covenant with a woman, and you are desiring not only to break the covenant that you're in, but to violate the covenant that he has made as well, which is says something. I mean, that's a much broader context for what it is that is happening here with the state of your soul than just you know what we normally think of as erotic desire or something like that. And the other thing I was going to say about the point that you were making, just by analogy, that it having, Deirdre, about it having a limited, the first thing I thought of was the situation with David and Bathsheba when you mentioned that, because when Uriah comes back, he's not supposed to have sexual relations because he's at war, mm-hmm. right? And David says, you know, go wash your feet, you know, and it's a euphemism for all of that as a way of trying to cover up for his own infidelity. But it occurred to me that there's a similar sort of thing that you could think about this passage in a similar sort of way, from that angle that you were suggesting. Like, during the time in which we are preaching the kingdom or something, like, is like a special time for, is this kind of what you mean? Like, yes, there is a special time here.
Yes.
And during that time,
yes,
orient your soul, your eye, yourself, your heart toward this thing and not that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Althea, you were going to say something.
What? Yeah. And I'm really appreciating how we're pulling this out, working on this particular verse with applicability to other parts of this section of Matthew. But I also wanted to get to a subtonal level with something you said, Deirdre. I'm sort of taking the gender approach in for this point. It's pulling up the woman. Because as Joshua rightly said, this is a man-to-man discussion. So in the sense that, yeah, Jesus is a man. And we can assume more readily the male view, the male hearing in this saying. But it's a man who is married to, who is not married to a woman, who is married to another man. You have broken something that is about the men's roles in each other's lives around the women that they have, mm-hmm, marital relationships with.
Mm-hmm.
But in that setting, the woman easily gets lost.
Yep.
As a site of negotiation. And Deirdre, you use the term objectify.
Yep.
So the question arises, even in this passage, have women been objectified while the men negotiate their rights around her body?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and so in the preaching of it, how to avoid continuing this implied objectification, so that it doesn't seep into the preaching or teaching moment, because we are so accustomed, perhaps, to thinking in that kind of way. You know, so amongst all the other emphases that we have been talking about, it's to pull up this woman who is somewhat objectified in this passage.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. There is merit to making that point absolutely clear and not to hypothesize what a woman in this context, how a woman in this context might function. I mean, we have women in Matthew's gospel, you know, so there are places where we can rightly make those our subject, but not here, not here.
Yeah, it's. I'm a little hesitant, but in the schema that we're just talking about, looking at it from a gendered perspective, there are other places where persons who have power of determination, power of decision making, and I mean biblical places, can actually discuss others, the other who is not in the same power position, in ways that make them invisible. You know, and yes. It just reminds me, this is not an application of this passage, but it just reminds me of the present time when so many decisions are being made that affect how women function in the world, and they're being made only by men.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm.
At the national level. And how easily it happens that those who are made invisible by our processes continue in invisibility if we do not name them, finger them, point to them, and lift them up.
We know that Jesus takes the demand of adults who have responsibility for dependents seriously in the gospel when he responds to the centurion in chapter 8, who's requesting healing for his Pice, his servant, perhaps one of his household members. We know that he responds favorably to the woman in chapter 15, the Canaanite woman who asks for help for her daughter, asks for healing for her daughter. So we have places where we can see that people are married, they do have children, they do have responsibility for households, and they're taking those responsibilities seriously enough to ask for a healing cure for a dependent in those communities. So maybe just as I want to include chapter 19, I should include the centurion in 8 and the Canaanite woman in 15 as well.
Yeah.
These are parents.
Yeah. Yeah. It, doing so does give us more freedom to avoid what might just be incidental to the rest of this particular verse or set of verses, to avoid continuing that taking for granted that the negotiations around the women are okay.
I was just as you both were talking about this, I was just looking at the other verses around it, and it does seem illuminating to look at it from the perspective of a communal context. I mean, just prior to that is the commandment against murder, and then saying, you know, if you're offering your gift, go be reconciled. You know, the accuser is established, tried to fix things outside of court prior to that. That it's like he's getting down to issues about power within the community and those who desire to transgress or violate bonds of community, and using different examples of that, whether that's, you know, the desire to violate a covenant that your neighbor has made, or these kinds of things. The nature of adultery, the nature and how that affects communal relationships.
And
I only mention that, well, I think it's helpful, first of all, but also because it certainly does not give women a voice in this situation, because it certainly doesn't reflect that perspective. But it does change the dynamic of what's going on. I suppose what I'm saying is, there's even a way to look at this commandment with a male gaze, I guess is what I mean. And that changing the dynamic and seeing it from the communal perspective, maybe a communal gaze rather than just the individual male gaze, might help us to get at the ways in which what Jesus is talking about here are about power dynamics that might be more broadly applied. Because it was one of the things I was thinking was like, well, could you reverse this like in the way that Jesus is saying here, gender wise, right? Is it a woman that looks at a man? Is mm-hmm. that the same thing? What about a woman looking at a woman? Mm-hmm. What about a man looking at a man? Like, what exactly is going on here? Mm-hmm. So anyway, just some observations.
But that last question, what your entire comment, one of the ways of looking at it with a community gaze is that, and with in a way that favors women and moves us towards a more liberative approach to the gender issues implicit here, is one that says these severe consequences are so severe because you ought not to violate a woman in this way. You mm-hmm. ought not right. to exercise mm-hmm. your power mm-hmm. in this way. Mm-hmm. And that is indeed a redressing of power balances or power right. imbalances.
You put very concisely what I was trying to get at. Yes.
Yeah. But I think you also kept the notion about that this is about how we live together in community, mm-hmm. And you kept alive the idea that we don't just go exercising our power in ways that are abusive yep. or unjust because we have it and we can.
Yep.
Right. Or just because you want it or you find something beautiful or even if you do find something beautiful, why do you want to dominate it or take it from someone? There's a lot of things going on here. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's also helping me to see one of the questions I had in mind earlier on, that we can look closely and perhaps correctly at the content of the law, but we can also try to figure out what is its function in the community. And I think if you keep your eye on the community and the complexities of trying to manage a collective life, that you can begin to see how some of these static looking rules are actually responsive to very, very, very fluid, moving, unsettled situations, mm-hmm. and trying to help us to figure out how to work through our lives. It's sort of like what Deirdre brought up about Joseph. Joseph knows the law, he's a righteous man, but when the time comes and what he knows in content is challenged by something relational, mm-hmm. then he behaves differently.
So helpful, because it's only in Matthew that we find the term ecclesia appears at all to describe the Matthean community around Jesus, the assembly. You know, ecclesia mm-hmm. in the Greek world has just a normal meaning of the gathering of people, the assembly around Jesus. In other words, it's a non-hierarchical community. Mm-hmm. But Matthew 23 makes it clear. Don't give special titles to people. Don't give honorary degrees. Don't defer to people in your community, you know, to give them the best places and so on. Because when you pray the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6, you say, "Our Father." Mm-hmm. And Jesus then becomes a sibling. Jesus becomes a sibling in this community.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that the bit of, is that what's going on in the last section about swearing by heaven and vows and yes and no, not invoking special powers or something like this?
Magical powers.
Right.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah.
And keeping, simple thing like keeping good faith.
Yes.
Don't swear falsely. Keep good faith. As a matter of fact, what would you make of "do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth"? But the idea of "do not swear by your head," just mm-hmm. don't swear. It's not, what can we make of that? Because I'm hearing not "don't ever take oaths," but really the emphasis is on as a community, and especially if it's a non-hierarchical community, then really it's important to keep good faith mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. each other.
Right.
Right.
I mean, it's clear that you make vows, carry yeah. out the vows you make to the Lord.
Right.
So there are things you swear to.
And covenants, in marriage covenants and things.
Legal covenants, yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if I could just go back a little bit to Deuteronomy and Sirach. We have come, just looking at Matthew, we've come to contemplate community. And the laws that the people have received may not constitute first and foremost ways of authorizing finger wagging at other people. But sort of this is a covenant we make with God, and it's also a covenant about how we live together. Mm-hmm. And these are the rules that express our agreement about how we are going to live together. So that and in Sirach there's a kind of reminder of the things that we have agreed to about how we're going to live together, and choosing life or death. We've sort of dealt with that, the insider, outsider, but choosing to be who we are as a people who have agreed around these, that is our life. Mm-hmm. That is our life without any implications as to whether others can be excluded. By the time you get back to Matthew, I'm really making a trip here, keeping mm-hmm. the community alive. You've heard that it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not swear falsely, or you shall not do this, or you shall not X, as Deirdre put it. It's that connection to the past which grounds you, but mm-hmm. then which you have to understand, not only in terms of the specifics, the specifications, but in terms of the intent of the specifications, which is to keep a community mm-hmm. as a community. Mm-hmm. around the things we have agreed to.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But think about how do we preach this? How do we teach this? And I really keep going back to what you said, Deirdre, about Matthew. And even what Jesus is implying here in 5:21 through 37. That we have this relationship to the past, what it models for us is a template of our community. But as a community, we keep thinking about that relationship to the past, adapting it to our present, and finding the ways that maintain the balance of fidelity to the past, but responsiveness to our present. So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not that's... a finger, I'm into finger wagging, perhaps, not finger wagging and saying, Jesus said you should not do this, therefore you do not do this. But Jesus is pointing us to that, to our community orientation.
Mm-hmm.
It's very helpful. It's very helpful. I'm just reminding myself of the way the whole thing begins with the blessings upon the poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek. I mean, these are all socially and economically inferior people. These are not the ruling class. These are not the ruling class at all. So becoming salt of the earth, light of the world, is not a power exercise. It's a sort of a manifestation exercise. So again, if we put these antitheses into the immediate context, as you both are doing, it's very helpful. It's very helpful. We're going to go on and talk about, well, the what isn't in our gospel, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, don't resist an evildoer. Mm-hmm. If anyone wants to sue you, take your coat, give your cloak as well. In other words, we're talking about strategies of resistance. We will be talking about strategies of resistance too. So things are taken from you, but there is a way by which you can reverse that. And take and give more, give to excess, which will leave you without much, but it will leave you in a superior frame of mind. So there are lots of dynamics going on here, just to fill that out, that you are both making excellent points about.
And again, even there, as we'll probably will come back to this later, but keeping that communal perspective in mind is also really helpful to think about in those instances.
We haven't said much about the Corinthian community, so maybe just briefly a few words about the way in which that description of community as servants. What then is Apollos? What then is Paul? If people say, I belong to Paul, I belong to Apollos, what does that mean? What does that mean? But these people to whom the Corinthians wish to assign themselves, they're servants. They're diakonoi. Mm-hmm. They're servants. They're not powerful people. And they each are dependent upon each other. So maybe the community theme can play out also in the Corinthians passage very well. The one who plants, the one who waters has a common purpose. We are all God's servants working together. You are God's field, God's building.
That's such an interesting part of this passage that had never jumped out to me until just then, that there's a way in which the Corinthian, by virtue of following a particular teacher or having been taught by a particular teacher or baptized by a particular person, are thinking themselves as like in terms of like disciples of that person.
Yeah.
But here Paul is saying that doesn't make any sense. We are servants.
Yeah, exactly.
Completely flipping that on its head, so that there would be some absurdity that would appear there.
Yep. Right. I'm a Harvard graduate, you know.
Anti-factionalism.
Yeah,
that is very much expressed here. The human will to sort of say, this is where I belong, these are my traits, I'm an, sort of gets challenged here. I'm a Paul follower, I'm an Apollos follower. Mm-hmm. Gets challenged here. I'd like to think, Deirdre, that some of that anti-hierarchical thinking is going on here in Paul too. I don't know if he completely succeeds in it throughout the Corinthian passage, Corinthian letter, but under God, this is God's work that we are involved with. And yeah, some people might have offices, even as he says later on in Corinthians, but at the end of the day, we are all together under God, and the field that they're working in belongs to God. There are all sorts of interesting implications here that we may not have time to go into, but that overcoming the tendency towards factionalism, mm-hmm. by a reminder of whose world this is, whose life this is, certainly is one of the huge challenges as human beings that we face.
And I'm particularly fond of the idea here that people who are imagining themselves as on some sort of, you know, mystical scale of hierarchy or something like that are being told flatly that they're infants and that they're really not even ready for solid food yet, but here it is. Yeah. Because they clearly think of themselves as that's exactly what they're arguing about.
I think what I'm stuttering over here too, yes. just to sort of press this in at the last minute.
Yes.
It's the idea of food and appropriate food. And even if we don't have hierarchies of office and value, we have an implication of growth and where, how we grow and what, that we have something to grow into. Mm-hmm. Part of the Christian faith, part of Christian community, does not permit you to assume that belonging means that you're fully ripe or fully mature,
mm-hmm.
whoever you are.
I think we should take a pause. This has been a really rich discussion, and it's making me think of other things, as I hope it's making all our listeners think of other things too, and things that they could preach and teach. So I'm very grateful, and I look forward to our next discussion. And I wish you, Joshua and Althea, a wonderful week of your busy jobs, and and our listeners a wonderful week as they continue in the season of Epiphany. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you all, and we'll pick it up again next week.
We will. Thank you. Goodbye.